Meeting will come to order. Welcome, everyone. Quorum is present. Let's have the approval of minutes from January 29th. Representative Stevenson.
Madam Chair, I would move that we adopt the minutes.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? Minutes are adopted. Members, today we're going to hear some stories of what's going on in Minnesota with regard to energy and how some of our Minnesotans are doing exceptionally well. That's what we're going to do today. I think it's going to be a learning opportunity for all of us. And we're going to start with Mayor Dave Kleiss of St. Cloud, and we'll welcome him to the committee. And if he'd like to bring up someone else, that would be great, too. And, of course, you know that you're supposed to put your name on the record.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Dave Kleiss, Mayor of the City of St. Cloud, and Pat Shea here also, who is our Director of Public Works. It's he and his team that really give credit for all of the creative things that we've been able to do. So I appreciate the opportunity to be here today.
Excellent. If you would.
Well, I know in the invitation to talk about some of the things we're doing, the issues of sustainability and the use of renewables and actually some issues. We're going to talk a little bit about what we've done with the elimination of phosphorus and some of our water quality also. And in general, the sustainability. But so I will I'll kind of talk a little bit. We were asked to be a little informal and have opportunity for questions, so that's what we will do, Madam Chair. So what we, you know, we have, you know, we set a goal a number of, we set a goal a decade ago of and a focus on sustainability. In fact, it was, you know, over the years we have tried very hard to focus on renewables. We were fortunate that we had one renewable we were using for a long time. Actually, we have a dam that was built in the 1970s on the Mississippi River, and that has provided energy for the city of St. Cloud, thanks to a wonderful collaboration partnership with Xcel Energy. And that facility finally was paid off this year.
This year.
So now, from here on out, there's more savings from the city's perspective, and we have the opportunity to actually put more of those savings into issues of sustainability. But we started down a path in 2015, based on a number of things, federal tax credits, especially on renewables. And we set a goal. In 2015, we were, with the exception of hydro in the city of St. Cloud, we were actually, our renewables were zero that we were using beyond hydro. And so we set a pretty aggressive goal that by 2018, you know, we wanted to be much greater than that. Actually, from overall, all of our city buildings, we were looking at being closer to the area of 80%. So we started in 2016 with a 0% renewable. In 2017, we were at 16%, and in 2018, this year, we're at 64%. And actually, there are days, you know, the aspect of, we're actually, if you take hydro, we're at 256% renewable. So we set a very aggressive timetable, a very aggressive goal, one that we knew we could achieve. We focused on solar. We started with just some solar panels on our wastewater treatment facility. Of all of the buildings in the city of St. Cloud, all of our government buildings, so water treatment, wastewater treatment, police, fire, library, all of those buildings, we're at the point now where we're a net producer of energy. All of those buildings are, you know, obviously the highest energy user going back to 2015 was our wastewater treatment facility. I'm looking at about 26% of our overall energy use was that facility. We're actually at that facility, I think 20, 30 days this year, we have actually been at 100% renewable, not hydro. So that's solar, biomass. And those are the two primarily that we have used. So we started with some solar panels on that facility. We ended up with a solar array land-based, and then we went from there to a number of our other buildings, buildings that in the city of St. Cloud. So we're using significant amount of renewables, and we're at the point now where at the wastewater treatment facility, for example, that energy again is produced, and then through an agreement with Xcel, we sell that to them. So we're in a position now that we're actually, as a city, we went from a significant cost. Our three biggest energy users were the wastewater plant, our water, and then our lighting system, so our streetlights. We actually went from 1 year, and I think it was 15 or 16 to 17, where we cut half of the cost of our lighting system. We went through a performance contract and did all LED. And so from an energy aspect, we have reduced significantly our wastewater treatment facility, which is an enterprise fund for us. It's not a property tax supported. It's supported by fees that our community, those who pay their utility bills. We've eliminated the cost, which was a significant piece of energy usage in that facility. We've also, and Mr. Shea talked a little bit about, we actually brought some these little bottles here. And I don't know if we should have been able to bring a whole box of fertilizer into the Capitol, but it's small enough. Hopefully we're all right. But this is we did this through a partnership a few years ago, and thanks actually to the legacy amendment, 75%, which was paid, and that's basically capturing at the wastewater treatment facility phosphorus. We've eliminated about 160,000 pounds.
Tons,
yeah, that's a bigger number than I deal in smaller amounts. Tons of phosphorus. We make this, we have a partnership, and we create a fertilizer that is sold in these little things. It's great for plants, and so there's actually revenue coming back to the city through this collaboration. If you look at the overall cost of our wastewater, which would have been one of our most expensive endeavors as a city, is actually now, from an energy aspect and from a renewable, we're at about 98%. Now, I'm going to turn this over because I want to make sure that the numbers are all accurate that you have, to our Public Works Director, Pat Shea, he and his team. But we set a very aggressive goal in a short period of time. We're at the point now, and then beyond just what we've been able to do with the city on renewables, we've also worked with a partnership with Xcel. We're part of some solar gardens that we participate in, I believe close to 30 of them that we're actually a partner in. And also the community is. So that's another aspect of where we're trying to work with our energy partners to encourage the same type of and from our perspective, I come from a perspective, and particularly one of the reasons some of these goals were set when we were hit with the recession like everybody else. From a government aspect, we were in a tough spot to really reduce those overall costs. So from an environmental aspect and from a sustainability and from a fiscal piece, we set very high goals so that we could manage better that piece of our government. So I'm going to turn it over to Pat Shea, and he's going to correct any numbers that I just gave you that were inaccurate. So I'll just, but he'll give you a little bit more of a detailed as to what he and his team were able to achieve.
Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Representative Wagenius. Thank you for having us today. I learned early on you never correct your boss, so everything you said was perfect. I will clarify a few things.
I'm trying to give your name for the record.
Patrick Shea, I'm Director of Public Services for the City of St. Cloud. I'm also the city representative on the Clean Water Council, and so I know some of you from that activity. Again, the City of St. Cloud's taking a, you know, it's a buzzword, but a proactive approach of looking at the most efficient way and the cheapest way to minimize your electrical use and electrical bills are through efficiency. So the mayor mentioned our streetlight improvement project where we upgraded the entire city over the process of about a year and a half. That was about a $7 million project. City buildings were included in that. And then the wastewater treatment facility, in the United States, about 40%, 35 to 40%, depending upon what metric you use, of all energy used in the United States is for drinking water and wastewater treatment. And City of St. Cloud is no different. We own and operate the wastewater treatment facility, but we serve really the entire central Minnesota region. We don't have a sewer commission that's owned, and that we have lease agreements with our area cities. And as part of that efficiency, we cut our electrical use back by about 20% prior to any energy development on site. The phosphorus recovery system is something that just went online very late 2018, and they're worth less than $5, so we brought samples for all of you. I've brought what I could, so hopefully there's enough. And it's a 5280 phosphorus blend. And again, efficient treatment of water really requires minimizing electrical use. It's an electrical use hog, as it were. City of St. Cloud has 8 solar arrays on city facilities, and an additional 8 will be in service in 2019. So if you're familiar with solar programs and how they work, there's programs through the electrical provider, and then there's the on-site solar. So you hear a community solar garden, or you hear solar garden, that's a specific term, specific program. So we'll have 16 arrays on city facilities. We use about 30 million kilowatt hours a year of electricity. And currently, if you extract that out, about 7 million kilowatt hours are used at the wastewater treatment facility. And hopefully by January 1st of 2021, that'll be 100% off the grid developed on site. The Struvite harvesting project was paid for by a 75% grant through the Clean Water Legacy Act funding. So it was a $6 million grant through the MPCA's Point Source Implementation Grant that we received that. And I think to sum up, we're open for questions, or do you have any closing?
No, that's, I've got to really appreciate the ingenuity of our folks, and in particularly the aspect of if you look at the recyclable at our wastewater facility, obviously the energy costs, but even the aspect of that plant in general, we recycle whether it be energy or whether it be cost, you know, the aspect of the fertilizer, we're about 98-99% recycled. So what we pull out of the our water source is the Mississippi River, and of course we have the best tasting water in Minnesota, at least in 2011, based on the State Fair poll. But I think I think International Falls beat us. It's just hard to compete that water source. But we put a lot of pride into the plant itself, the fact that its efficiency and being able to recycle that, and actually in this case bring some dollars in through the utilization of a partnership. All of what we have been able to achieve has been because of the partnerships. If you look at the solar piece, we didn't put a capital investment. We did performance contract, so there was no financial risk to the city, only financial benefit. In fact, if we go beyond even where we originally, we started that process. So we have a municipal athletic complex that has hockey, we started actually a process there with about 11 years ago with a firm to do a performance contract to put in. In that case, we used geothermal, and they put all of the capital in, of course, and took all the risk, and then were to guarantee us the energy savings. And from a natural gas aspect, we reduced the natural gas usage there by about 98%. Now, the electricity, they did not meet the performance on that level, and it was wonderful to have that performance contract. So they paid what that energy savings should have been for. They dealt with the capital piece, and they paid the bonds on that. So that was our first endeavor going into the performance contract. What we have for solar is all performance contract. In fact, we have 8 of our buildings that have the solar array now. We will double that, so we'll add 8 this year. We just approved that on Monday night. Again, in with a performance contract guaranteeing the savings that actually pay for the capital costs. So there's this really, because of the ability for us to partner, we've been able to succeed, and we've seen some great results.
There are some questions. Representative Acom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And welcome. Before coming to the State House, I came from the City Council level, and so am very familiar with city issues. And while you are doing great things in St. Cloud, and I appreciate all of them, I found that in order to successfully make that economic argument and environmental argument, there usually is a local champion. I'm just wondering how you guys got started doing this. And you started in 2015, and you've done incredible things in that short time. And so just wondering how things got started in St. Cloud.
Well, and I appreciate, Madam Chair and Representative, you came from the city part, and then I went the opposite. I was in the other body, in the Senate, for 11 years and served in this building, and went to the local piece. The champion really has been the community. We started with what was called we had a sustainability expo that we did about 13 years ago or 12 years ago. And we on an annual basis, we would just talk about areas that we can, reduce or help with the environment, but also help reduce our costs overall in that, at that time. But it was something we did on an annual basis. We did that for about 3 years, and then we incorporated that sustainability expo into everything we do. So every department had a task that we from the administration would task them with, is to reduce your overall costs, and in particularly energy. So in the collaboration with Apache here, our director and his team, and maybe not a champion in that respect, but you've served in that perspective. When you're not giving them any resources, they've got to figure out creative ways to do their job. So from that piece, and the recession really precipitated into a way that really it caused us to do things differently, and in order for us and I would say probably a lot of, some of the decisions that are made here and at the federal government, tax credits. I mean, there was an incentive for someone to come and partner with us for those initiatives. There's no doubt that wouldn't have happened if there wouldn't have been those types of incentives. As we talked about before with our phosphorus, that's a legacy grant. So there's some things that have happened here that have helped us in that area. But our champions have really been a number of folks in the community. We've had people that have been very, supportive of what we're doing. And we haven't, when it comes to, your utility bill, as a former city council member, those are, the rates. And we've done some major expansions both in our wastewater. I don't know what's wastewater called now. There's a new term now. Every year there's a new term. It used to be the sewer plant. Now, of course, it's wastewater. What is it now?
So we're branding new recovery, so nutrients, energy, and water recovery facility.
I haven't been used to that new branding yet. So now that's what that's called, but it's the old sewer plant when I was growing up. But we've taken that, and when we've been able to do is reduce those, and quite frankly, we've done some major expansions in the wastewater treatment facility. We did a $50 million expansion a few years ago, and we do that on a regional basis. So the city of St. Cloud, Sartell, Wade Park, Sauk Rapids, St. Augusta, that is on our treatment facility. We share that cost, and we share that as a plant. We, the city of St. Cloud, operate it. When it comes to water, it's the city of St. Cloud and then St. Augusta, so we share that also. But we've kept our rates down you know, significantly. Your utility, your overall entire utility bill on a monthly basis in St. Cloud is about $26, $28. So that's a pretty low, and that's sewer and water and garbage. So that's a pretty. So our focus is to try to reduce that cost, forced, of course, based on the recession, and quite frankly, from a philosophical aspect. So our champions become our ratepayers, and particularly some of our large ratepayers, the business community, have been really our champions. And we've actually worked with the business community. Some of what we're doing with the energy production, we're working with some dairy folks, the waste, and we're working with some brewers, some beer manufacturers, and because there's a waste there that we can convert into energy. So we're doing that. We also had a wonderful conversation. We have a bottler, Coca-Cola bottler, that again, there's the byproduct, the sugar that we can convert into energy. So we've partnered with some and got them to also do some things at their level that can help reduce their overall costs, but also together we can reduce their overall costs. So the partnerships, I think, have been the greatest part. So our champions have been our partners.
Two more questions, and then we'll go on. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first of all, I'm confused on how to address the testifier because he is a former senator and a mayor now, and you're supposed to refer to someone by their highest title earned. Well, obviously, we know former senator is much better than senator, and we know that mayor is somewhere in that hierarchy. So how do I address the testifier there in terms of your time?
Well, and as Madam Chair and Representative, as you know, and being in government, there's ways that people address me all the time. I prefer you don't use those. in the capacity that I serve now, I'm very proud to be mayor, so I appreciate that. It's that local piece, you know, as I tell folks. You know, it's the morning when you have to turn on your water or flush your toilet, and right now it's the snow plowing. And somehow, as you know, I discovered when I was a legislator versus being a mayor. As a legislator, you spread that blame to all. As mayor, you're the only one who's responsible for the cold weather. You know, it's one of those things. So I appreciate that piece. So, and I'm sorry, I was in the other body. I remember that. That when I was here, we couldn't mention the other,
It's probably a good idea. Madam Chair and Mr. Mayor, did you say that the City of St. Cloud is part of the Solar Gardens program?
Yeah, that's correct. XL Energy's Community Solar Garden Program.
And so, Madam Chair and to the testifier, when you're as a member of that, do you find that contained within that program are the power bills that you pay, when I say you, I mean the city, are the power bills you paying, are they higher or are they lower than if you were just paying a standard electricity?
We will save $180,000 in 2018 compared to what we would be paying if we hadn't been members.
So, Madam Chair, and to the testifier, as I think the committee knows, and perhaps the testifier may or may not know, the actual purchase price for the energy is substantially higher than the alternative forms of energy, even the retail cost of electricity. So there's a difference between cost and price. Right. The price may be lower for the city, but the cost is higher for all XL ratepayers. And so my question is that given that energy pricing tends to have a regressive impact on lower and middle income folks, while this is saving money for the city, low income ratepayers across the XL service territory are paying more for their energy as a result of this. Not saving money, I mean, the city's saving money, but ratepayers are actually paying more. Does the city have any concerns about that dynamic that's taking place?
Well, I think from the city's perspective, and again, that's been our focus on whether it be the hydro or whether it be on the solar piece, we're actually, you know, you'd be paying in those costs and in your rates that we would have. You'd be paying that in your, you know, this is an enterprise fund for us, so it's not property tax subsidy that we put into it. But even the technology, if we look back a few years ago when we were looking at solar, Beck, we looked at solar 13 years ago before some of those, and I don't disagree, Madam Chair and Representative, the aspect of the subsidy of it. It was financially out of our reach. We couldn't, you know, the aspect of, for us, and even with the technology and even the contracts that we have, We've seen the cost overall of that technology and advance significantly over the period of time, and there, in every aspect of projection is that that will continue at that level. So, no, I think the what the ratepayer in St. Cloud, whether it be property tax or what they're paying on this utility, our utility, the only utility we have a control over, we're trying to reduce those costs and have that long-term sustainable. In fact, the contracts that we have are built in that way. There's no, regardless of what happens to the vendors that we're using, our ratepayers aren't going to see an increase, meaning the city and then, of course, the ratepayers from some of that perspective. I would leave those other aspects to is in your area of what you're going to be dealing with. But from our perspective, I'm focusing on the ratepayers that I have, and they're paying the utilities, and we're bringing those costs down.
So, Madam Chair, I think it's just important for members of the committee to point out that, you know, there's something called nuance when it comes to clean energy, and not all clean energy is the same price. Wind is far cheaper than the community solar program. Utility-scale solar, far more cost-effective than the community solar program. But right now we are seeing rapid price increases among the Xcel service territory, not because I'm faulting the city. It's not the government of the city of St. Cloud's fault. You're getting lower rates out of it. But those costs are being shifted, and you know, I'm sure it's the first time everyone here has heard about this, but there is cost shifting that takes place. And by shifting that cost onto other ratepayers, it's having an adverse impact, particularly in the private sector.
If we can have the next, we're going to go into the next question here. Representative Bierman, and then Mo, and then we'll go.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Testifier. I don't want to miss all these other good.
Sure, things. Understand. Thank you. So a bunch of my questions were answered from you, from Rep. Acombe, but I just wanted to commend you on the great work you've done up there in St. Cloud over this time period, and I'm impressed with the timeline. The question I had was in regards to buy-in from the community, and so you answered a lot of those questions very thoroughly and gave me a lot to think about as your how your achievements have gone so quickly. So there was a lot of spade work done a decade before, you know, now, and that really, that zero renewables from 2015 to 2018 difference was just startling. And so I held myself back to stand up and applaud you for that, because that's very, very impressive, and it sort of gives us a guideline to do. And as Representative Garofalo pointed out, there are issues that connect to other communities and other stakeholders in all of this, but it's important to deal with what we can as you can in your community, and I do want to commend you for that. I did want to ask a little bit more about the phosphorus in the water and kind of what drove you to take that step and what other issues you might be seeing in the water up in St. Cloud with the dam and the water treatment.
Okay, well, I'll start with the phosphorus recovery system. So it's from human waste. It's a wastewater treatment process that we've implemented, and along with the Clean Water Legacy grant funding to kind of push it over the top and make it a sustainable activity. So we currently land apply a biofertilizer similar to many communities, not just in the state of Minnesota but across the country, as kind of the recycling process of what we do. And as part of that, nitrogen will be taken up by the plants very readily. Phosphorus is a little bit more troublesome. And so we saw a need, you know, really looking past 5-10 years of what standards will be, and just making sure we're minimizing the amount of phosphorus we put on farm fields as part of that program. So those were kind of the two drivers that really put us there. And then the public-private aspect of that, there's we have a 15-year contract with a fertilizer supplier that will buy it from us. And then they take it to actually phosphorus-deficient areas of the country and use it there. Phosphorus is a mine product, so all the phosphorus that you have in your fertilizer and the agricultural community will use is a mine product, not in the United States. So it's a... The projections are we may have 50 to 80 years worth of phosphorus left before it's all at the bottom of the ocean through wastewater discharges and use of that sort. So it's another looming crisis that may be out there, and so this is just an opportunity to you know, take advantage of that. Drinking water, kind of the same thing. If I always use the analogy, if you watch a golf on Sunday afternoon and you just watch the commercials, every one of those new products that are coming out in those commercials is going to end up in your water one way or the other. So just planning, we just are in this planning stages for kind of the next level of treatment in the drinking water system, about a $35 million project. A lot of these will be funded through user rates, that sort of thing. And then the dam, about a 40-year-old structure, so just normal wear and tear maintenance, that sort of thing. But we work very carefully and closely with the Corps of Engineers and the DNR and all those on the permitting of that. So those operations just kind of keep things afloat.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Bowe, a very quick question.
Absolutely. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Mayor, I know you mentioned that you were putting some solar panels on the rooftops of local city buildings. I've heard from some entities that are having issues with the cost of dealing with solar arrays, solar panels at the end of life. And so I'm wondering, how do you as a city address those? Do you have a hook in your contract that they'll take care of those at the end of life? Or how do you address that potential loss of benefit when you have to pay the cost for getting rid of them?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. Yes, we have that. That's part of the contract. It's still our roof and their product, and at the end of life, or at the end of the technology, and if there's better technology, we can renew those types of contracts. But yes, it's still our roof, and their product would need to be removed from our roof at the end of that contract.
Thank you.
At the expense of our vendors.
Thank you all so much for coming. Really appreciate your story and what you've done. So.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members. We appreciate the opportunity to be here. So appreciate it.
Thank you.
Mayor Norton could not come, but you will find her comments are in your packet and online. Michael Reese. We're going to be about 15 minutes with questions.
Okay. Madam Chair, thank you very much for this opportunity. My name is Michael Reese. I direct the Renewable Energy Program at the University of Minnesota West Central Research and Outreach Center. And I want to, first of all, thank you very much for this honor of testifying before your committee and before all committee members. Today I'd like to visit with you about the work that's going on at in the city of Morris and in our county, Stevens County, and at the university located in around Morris. We like to turn this the Morris model. But before I talk about the Morris model, I want to talk about has been done at the Research and Outreach Center. We're an agricultural experiment station at our sister campus, University of Minnesota Morris. We've had installed two 1.65 megawatt wind turbines that provide approximately 70% of the power for the University of Minnesota Morris campus. A portion of that energy is also used to produce hydrogen and anhydrous ammonia, which is nitrogen fertilizer, and also potential energy storage medium. And that's a research facility. We have 131 kW of solar photovoltaic, two 10 kW small wind turbines, as well as three thermal solar systems. And here's an example of the solar PV systems that we have installed. And we, at the Research and Outreach Center, we have a goal to reduce fossil energy consumption and production agriculture. So much of our focus on renewable energy is on the utilization side and how to better utilize the power so that utilities don't necessarily have to do that on our grid. You know, we're in a rural area. We don't have the distribution, robust distribution system that you would hear in more urban areas. And I'd draw your attention to the slide at the bottom. We're looking for opportunities to better utilize solar PV, for example, by providing shade for for livestock. We also have solar thermal. We use that to provide space heating and cooling for our office, as well as produce hot water for the office. Mentioned that we try to utilize solar PV more effectively, and we do that by cooling mother pigs' cells and by heating piglets in unique and effective ways, more efficient ways. We also work to develop a net zero energy dairy parlor where we're using solar PV and small wind to dry the process, which cools the milk, and we capture that heat off the milk to preheat water that's used to sanitize the milk lines. So we believe that this is a much more efficient system to drive a heat pump and heat exchange rather than use natural gas or some other fossil energy. In addition, we have a globally unique renewable hydrogen and ammonia pilot plant where we take wind energy, we electrolyze water, form hydrogen, and we pull nitrogen from the air, combine them together to produce anhydrous ammonia, which is the predominant nitrogen fertilizer used in Minnesota and across the Corn Belt. That has gained attention from the Department of Energy as a energy storage medium as well, and some believe that it's more cost-effective than using batteries. We have installed a DC electric vehicle fast charger in Morris. It's the only one right now, currently, a non-Tesla charger west of Monticello, and I think the next closest is Denver. So we're kind of out there on an island, and we have a lot of traffic through there on people's ways way to Fargo, for example, or to Denver and other places across the U.S. We have electric Bolt car, and we also work with electric utility vehicles on our farm, such as a Polaris Ranger, and it's been very effective for the work we do. Our sister campus, University of Minnesota Morris, has a district heating and cooling system, combined heat and power plant, in which they use biomass gasification. They have a goal to be carbon neutral by 2020. Not sure they're going to reach that goal, but they're currently at about 70 to 75% of that goal at this point in time. So I'd like to switch gears a little bit to talk about the Morris model. The Morris model is a loosely knit group of organizations and stakeholders within Morris and Stevens County community looking to advance goals in the areas of energy, transportation, waste reduction, and improve recycling and education of these topics. Some significant outcomes: we had a strategic planning retreat in the last part of October in which West Central Initiative provided a community planning grant for us to get together to talk about these. We had issues. We had 35 individuals from a cross-section of the community, from business, from the school system, from city, from county, and our utility, Otter Tail Power, also participated. As a result of that, we developed a Morris Community Climate Smart Municipality Strategic Plan. So we have goals in energy, transportation, waste reduction, recycling, and education. And our next step is to take these organizational goals and get formal approval from each body. And along with that, we developed a project list of 100 projects to help prioritize these efforts and help achieve goals. Each organization can take a look at that project list and choose for themselves what makes the most sense. The Morris Model Team has provided leadership. We conducted educational events and advocated for renewable energy systems, such as solar PV for the high school, a $30 million biomass upgrade plant that's planned for Stevens County. That's a result of some of the efforts of a local dairy. And we've also advocated to increase the use of locally produced and distributed E85 ethanol. And when you look at the Denco 2 plant, ethanol plant in Morris, and see that they produce E85 and they distribute it directly to the gas stations in our area. And really, that's take corn from Stevens County, produce ethanol, distributed to the gas stations. That's kind of what I consider to be the pinnacle of a circular economy. Here's a picture of our community strategic planning retreat. We have representatives, again, from Riverview Dairy, from Otter Tail Power, from Superior Industry, major manufacturer, from our local government organizations, as well as the university, and local citizens participated. So our vision is for Morris to be recognized as a national leader in innovation, energy, transportation, waste reduction, recycling. We hope to create a more robust economy within our agriculture and manufacturing sectors, create new businesses, jobs, and wealth for our community. And we hope this process will make us more economically, environmentally resilient. We want to produce all energy locally, keeping more money within our community, provide greater opportunities for local ownership, inspire a new conservation ethic for saving energy, reducing waste, develop innovative educational programs for students and all community members, and become a destination for those wanting to learn and businesses wanting to participate. So as a result of this retreat, we developed three big goals. We want to produce 80% of the energy consumed in the county by 2030, reduce energy consumption 30% by 2030, and have no landfilling of waste generated within our county by 2025. And I admit these are very aggressive goals and will be difficult to achieve, but I think we will continue to work at these goals to better our community. Just a little demographics. Morris has about 5,300 people, the city of Morris. Stevens County has close to 10,000 people. In just to give you a little perspective, I believe we have about 26,000 dairy cows in our county, so more livestock than people. But if you look at the energy that is used in our county, in our community, we did a real high-level estimation. And if you look at the energy used on farms, it results in about $95 million a year going outside of our county. And you can look down through all the different energy sources and the amounts of money that we spent. Interestingly, nitrogen fertilizer is about $29 million per year, which is made by steam methane reforming of natural gas. And then you look at the city, city spends about $17.5 million. So if you look at the total energy picture of Stevens County, about $112 million annually goes out of the county, with one exception. We do export ethanol, so we capture some of that added value. And again, we hope to export biogas and other forms of renewable energy in the near future. We participate in a program called the Climate Smart Municipality Partnership. It's led by the University of Minnesota. It pairs what used to be five and now six Minnesota communities with communities in Germany, in the state of North Rhine-Westphalia. It's funded in large part by the German government, and representatives from each community exchange information by visiting the other communities and seeing successes and failures. And the city of Morris has signed a second partnership agreement with the city of Zerbeck. And the city of Zerbeck is a world leader in this area. They produce over 400% of the energy consumed within the city with large-scale wind, solar PV, biogas, biomass. They have local ownership, and they focus quite a bit on educational programs. Now, as I'm sure many of you realize, Germany has a different policy and regulatory environment than what we have in the U.S., but we learn by experiencing their technologies, and they learn by how we're able to still move forward on these efforts, considering, you know, the differences in energy prices we have here. So in Zerbeck, we see innovations, such as in the Zerbeck Energy Park, where they have local-owned wind, solar PV, two biogas plants, one that composts organic waste and the other that produces biogas from local animal residues. We see disruptive technology, such as electric vehicles, electric cars, this electric bus that you see on the left side of the screen. We see new approaches to old problems, such as the Zerbeck Compost Center. They cannot landfill any waste in their state, so they have to recycle all of their waste and combust or do some other something else with the small amount that's remaining. When they come here, they meet with local policymakers and utilities. They meet with our local farmers and business owners, such as Grant County Wind and Riverview Dairy. They visit our schools, our administrators, they talk with students. And I think that's probably the most important part here is educating our youth. So in my conclusions, if I were to give recommendations to other communities, I would say educate at all levels to improve awareness and drive cultural change, set local goals, work together to provide policy, regulatory, financial, and technical framework for successful projects, and then lead the way. That was brought up earlier. Who leads these efforts? And that's a big part that in a small community like Morris, everyone's busy. Just take someone to step up and say this is important for our future. So, again, thank you for this opportunity.
Great story. We have just like a minute for questions. Representative Hornstein, and then we'll go on to the next testifier.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and good to see you again. I actually teach a class at the U of M, and we take an annual field trip up to Morris. And it's very impressive. I would really recommend people take a tour, and they offer those. I wanted to ask a little more about the composting. You mentioned the in Sarbeck, but what are you doing? I know that there's source-separated composting in your in the residence halls and in the the dining hall, et cetera. Do you have how much do you collect, and is there a market for that source-separated organics that you collect?
Madam Chair, Representative Hornstein, I work at the Research and Outreach Center, so we're a little bit different from the UMM campus, but they do have a organic recycling program that they started as a test, and I'm not sure, to be honest with you, what they are doing with their organics. I know organics is a huge issue. Stevens County sends half of our waste to Pope Douglas Waste Center in Alexandria, and they say that about 40% of the waste is organics. So if we're going to reduce our landfill and eliminate it, we need to address how to deal with organics in that waste stream. So it is a big issue.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for coming. I really appreciate it. I have been to Morris, too, and highly recommend visiting when they have some of their seminars.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Pat Collins, who is a teacher at Chicago Lakes Middle School. Chicago. I'm used to Chicago. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. It's good to be here. My name is Pat Collins. I'm a middle school science teacher. I've been teaching seventh grade science for 35 years, which is why I look this old. And I'm not used to having people pay this good of attention, so if you rap your neighbor or play with your phone or fidget a little bit, I'll probably be a little bit more comfortable up here. I think as a teacher, there's two big questions that pop up in the room before you start any lesson or any year. And the first question is, you know, what are we really teaching kids? And my curriculum coordinator, my principal would say, well, I hope you're teaching the standards. And we do. But the truth is there's a lot bigger fish to fry than that. For a kid, they want to know, how is this relevant to me? But it generally doesn't come out that way. It comes out like, why do I need to know this crap? So as a teacher of life science, you know, we're talking about energy, and it's all about energy. And when you talk about climate change with kids, they shut down really fast if you don't offer hope and ways out. And so you can't talk about it unless you have positive things to say too. And so in 2008, a student asked, why don't we have solar panels on our school? Why can't we do that? And so we started down that road, and we kicked it around, and we said, all right, what if we put up a 10-kilowatt system? So I did a little research and came back to class and said, it's $103,000. And, of course, right away the kids go, well, the school will pay for that, right? No, schools don't have any money. I mean, we're cutting out pink paper, you know, to save 10 cents a ream, you know. And so I go to the principal, and I said, here's what we want to try to do. And he says, now, it's 2008. The economy has just fallen apart. Everybody's broke. And you want $103,000 to put up 44 solar panels? I think the answer to that is no. And I said, no, I don't want anything. I just want the opportunity to work with a bunch of kids in a school and see if we can raise the money. And we've had pretty good success with other things in the years, and I haven't screwed up anything too bad yet. So he said, well, you got to sell it to the school board. Well, I know the school board pretty well, so I went to the school board and said, here's what I want to do. I want to raise $103,000. I think we can get a lot of grants and blah, blah, blah. And school board looked at each other and said, but what if you get, like, partway there? Isn't this going to be a horrible lesson for kids? And I said, but what if we can get there? And they said, well, you think about it a little bit more and come back in a couple weeks, and we'll think about it a little bit more. And so a couple weeks later, I was smart enough to know that I wasn't going to sell them on this issue. So I brought three of my best seventh graders. And they came, and they not only had, you know, them and their buddies, they had their parents and their grandparents. And one young lady sat up there and sang the praises, and you just swore she was 50 years old. And I think the school board pretty much had to say yes when they looked in the front row, and there was her grandfather, and he was crying, you know, as he's watching her, which I thought was incredibly cool. So they end up saying, yeah, go ahead, which is like, oh, crap, what do we get ourselves into now? And so we started raising money, and we had dances, and we sold T-shirts. We got trees from a company, and we raised those into big trees in our garden and then sold them to local homeowners. We had a 5K run. We raided piggy banks. Even our janitors got involved by having us spit gum into buckets, and then they would pay us by the pound rather than have to scrape it off the floor. And in 2010, believe it or not, our price had gone from $103,000 down to $73,000, and we made it. And we had a lot of, you know, wonderful things happen along the way. And we dedicated our 10-kilowatt system with 44 panels, and we had a big ribbon-cutting ceremony. It was a whole town showed up. It was really cool. We're a small town in Lindstrom. You know, this is big stuff. And that's where I thought it would stop. But being a nerd, I put out a Google alert on something called third-party leasing, where somebody with big money comes in and invests in solar panels, and you know, they get the tax write-off, and 6 years later they say, here, they're yours now. And we have to pay rent in the meantime, but we're net positive because we're making $50 a month on the rent. And luckily, 2 years later, we hit on that, and we talked to the people at Innovative Power Systems and said, can schools do this or nonprofits? And they said, nobody's asked yet. So we got in applications for our five schools before anybody else knew about it, and we got three of the schools at a grant was, I think it was $722,000. So now we got, instead of 10 kilowatts and 44 panels, we have 40 kilowatts on three of the five buildings, and then a year or two later, we got the other two as well. So we had 40 kilowatts in every school, and we were feeling pretty good about that, and that's where I thought it would stop. And then the business manager calls me, and she's about as sharp a lady as you'll ever meet, and she says, Solar Gardens want us to buy into them because they're struggling a little bit. What do you think? And I said, well, what do you think? And she says, I think it's a no-brainer. And you keep hearing those two words all the time with solar. And so they bought into local solar farms. So right now our school district has 15,000 solar panels that they either lease or own. And, you know, when you take a look at that, we're the first school district in the state. It's 110% solar powered and one of the first in the country. We're going to save $3 to $6 million. And I tell you what, that's a lot of bake sales when you're trying to come up with that kind of money to help schools out. And the good news is we'll prevent 56 million pounds of carbon dioxide from being emitted. But I still think both of those are secondary goals and objectives. You know, schools need funding help. My principal told me he'd give me the day off if I came down and said that. But school's canceled today, so. And we compete for students, too. So we have people in our surrounding districts that think our old building looks kind of hip now with solar panels on top. And we save a lot of money. And that's where I thought all this stuff would end. But then Paul Douglas got involved, and he came up and put on a show up there talking about climate change and renewable energy. He drug along a guy named Mitch Hescox, who's the leader of the Evangelical Environmental Network, who was coming up from D.C., and he kept telling me, how many people do you think we can get? And I said, God, I think we can get, you know, more than you got in Richfield. You got 75 people there. I'll guarantee you we'll get more than that. And we ended up with 400 people there, and that was pretty cool. And we had solar companies there giving quotes, and it was really a cool deal, and that's kind of where I thought it would end. But this fall, the University of Minnesota asked us if we would host a preview screening of a movie called The Power of Minnesota. And I thought that was pretty cool, too. And we got 200 people to that and more solar people and so on. And again, that's where I thought it would end. And you know, but it just keeps going on. I mean, this year I'm getting a physical and I'm wearing one of those wonderful robes that every one of you loves. And I'm standing there and the doctor's giving me the physical. And all of a sudden he says, oh, you know, I went to that Paul Douglas thing and I put solar in my building. And here he is, you know, talking to me while my bare butt's hanging out about solar. And it's like, okay, this is wonderful. So I think the question we always have to get to is what are we teaching kids? And we're teaching kids that you can save a lot of money. We're teaching kids this is good for the environment. But in the world we live in today with, you know, all the mental health crises we're dealing with and funding issues, we're teaching kids that they are David and maybe climate change is Goliath. And that through their actions, I think they can win. And I think they're incredibly powerful because they have power over two groups of people, one being their parents and two being their grandparents. Because maybe grandpa doesn't want to recycle, but he will for that little girl over there. So I think we teach kids innovation, empowerment. I think we teach them that things aren't easy and you have to work really hard at it. I think you teach them that they can change the world, to not to accept things as they are, that solar is a no-brainer, that we build community, and we allocate resources perhaps to other venues if we don't have to pay for power. So I would love to have you guys encourage people, encourage schools by maybe offering matching grants. I don't think you should put it in their hands. I think you should put it in their reach. And I think we can teach kids what's really important along with the standards as well. So thank you for the opportunity to come here today. Appreciate it very much.
We are impressed. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the testifier. And whenever we have an opportunity to put real-life examples for kids to learn math, science, technology, and engineering, that's a good thing. But we also have the same shared objectives, I think all of us do, that we want to see pollution reduced, we want to save money, and wherever possible, we want to keep dollars in the state of Minnesota. So that's the good part. Okay, so let's get to the bad part now. Let's work out the math on this on that first solar array we talked about. $73,000 for a 10-kilowatt array. Now, does your array have these metrics where you can put it up online and you can see the annual production amount?
Yeah.
Okay. So my guess is that your capacity factor is probably about 15%. Is that?
I don't honestly know that answer. You know?
Okay, so Madam Chair to the testifier, so assuming a 15% capacity factor on a 10-kilowatt solar array, it's going to generate about 13 megawatt hours over the course of a year, 13,140 kilowatt hours. If we assume the price of that energy that they're paying is 15 cents a kilowatt hour, which is probably, it's actually probably cheaper than that when they pay it on the retail market, but we'll overestimate it. We'll say it's 15 cents. The value of that energy that they are avoiding is $1,971. So for a $73,000 investment, they're getting about $2,000 a year in energy. Now, as I mentioned at the beginning of my comments, the math, science, technology, and engineering stuff, it's not meant to be profitable, right? You're imparting knowledge on kids, and that's a great experience. But my concern is that when we talk to kids and we talk to members of the public and we say, this is a project that is saving money. No, it's not. It's not saving money. There's cost shifting involved. We say, well, it's reducing pollution. Not really, because what's happening is the solar array is not shutting down a coal plant. It's not shutting off a peaker. It's generally going to be a combined cycle natural gas power plant, which just does not emit. I mean, it burns clean enough that we burn it inside our homes with no filters. The one thing that it does do is you can say that it keeps the money in the state of Minnesota. And so as we're going forward with these ideas of putting solar panels on every school's roof or reducing pollution or trying to save money, realize that this is an exceptionally expensive way to generate electricity. It's an exceptionally expensive way to reduce pollution. And that if the stated goals are the real goals, that we want to keep energy dollars in Minnesota, we want to reduce pollution, and we want to save districts money, there are far more cost-effective ways to provide 5 and 6 times the bang for the buck. So thank you.
It's going to be interesting how we can find ways to teach values, which you have eliminated here. Representative Long.
Thank you very much. This is a really exciting and I think pretty visionary project that you all undertook. You mentioned the tons of carbon dioxide that you had avoided. Can you remind us what that number was?
I think the number was 56 million.
56 million.
That's what Innovative Power Systems has told us that it is.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So one way, one part of the cost that we're not talking about is the externalities of the costs on people's health and on the environment. The estimate for that the EPA uses is $40 a ton. So if we're talking about $56 million, I'm not very good at mental math, but that's a lot of dollars that we're talking about in terms of the social costs that you are avoiding in terms of reducing carbon pollution as well. Is that a fair statement?
Absolutely, and healthcare costs as well. But we also look at the rules. I mean, out of that 73,000, I think our net number was about $17,000 that we had to raise. And then we had in-kind labor, we had grants. We play by the same rules that businesses and farmers and everybody else does that takes advantage of the incentives that are out there. So I think it's a great cost savings. And you know, when you look at that number, 3 to 6 million, when you talk to people from the power companies, you know, Innovative Power Systems, whatever, they always tell us, here's what it will be on the low end, but they don't like to tell us what it'll be in the high end. But I know what our business manager likes about it as much as anything is the simple fact that we know what our utility rates are going to be, and they can project out costs for the next 30 years because we know we have one constant right here. And I also, you know, read enough to know that wind and solar are amongst the cheapest energies that we can get.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Last question, Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Collins. I had to speak up because Chisago Lakes is my hometown. Graduated from Chisago Lakes. I was learning about the energy crisis at Chisago Lakes when I was a student there and what we could do. And a few things that I'm struck by. One, I'm super proud of the way that Chisago County has stepped up and become such a leader in renewable energy in the state. I think that Paul Douglas mentions in the article that's not what most people expect when they think about where the renewable energy push is coming from in the state of Minnesota, and that it's coming from this small town in still a pretty rural part of the state. In addition, I think that you did something really important, and whenever I talk to kids, I always tell them, don't underestimate your power. It's amazing the power that kids have that they don't know that they have. I don't think there's a single person here that is going to say no to a kid when they want to have a meeting or talk to us about something, because I think that we all get really inspired by the future. The other thing I think that is really clear when I watch young people organize in this day and age is they're holding us to task because we're the ones who built the problems that they're going to have to solve. And we have to act very rapidly as we've been hearing. And so this ingenuity to me is really exciting. And so I hope that you invite them to come up to the Capitol at some point and continue to educate policymakers about the work that they're doing. I'd be happy to host them. I know many of us would. One of the things that I'm curious about, and I'm very concerned about Representative Garofalo, because I have a vision of a cloud following him around over his head, and want to assure him that the sun does shine in this state, and that we don't get to produce a lot of fossil fuel-based energy in Minnesota. We do get to produce a lot of solar, and we do get to produce a lot of wind. And so if we want to be sure to be creating a green energy future, this is something that economically has many dimensions and many layers in terms of the boots on the roof, the people who are doing the work, the manufacturers in our state, and then you know, public entities and private entities. Like I see Eichton's Cheese Farm has a solar farm. Go get some cheese at Eichton's Cheese Farm. That this all has a multi-layered economic impact as opposed to being a one-off, a positive or negative. And I don't know if you have any follow-up to that or can shed any light.
I know one of the things we're starting to struggle a little bit with up there is people saying, I don't want this next to my house. I don't want this solar field here. And, you know, when you have conversations of, well, that cornfield is really just an energy field too. And which one produces more BTUs? The solar is very much the winner. But I think the one thing that bothers me a little bit is, you know, I'm 58, and if I go to some of these rallies and if I go to some of the environmental things, I hate to say it, but I'm one of the young guys there. And I look at it and think, okay, you know, the actuary tells me I got 21 years left. But when I look at little kids that are 12 and 13, you know, they've got a long time left to do good things. And we have to empower them. And if we don't empower them, then they sit back and just accept what it is. And I love it when kids say, why can't we do that? And for them to do that and then be successful at it is a great lesson for them to learn. So,
thank you.
Madam Chair, my name was used, so I had to respond to that quickly. Less than 30 seconds.
Less than 30 seconds.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Halverson, I know this committee has a focus on science and data. So I would just, my colleague from Dakota County, we should point out that I don't live in a world of aspirations. I live in a world of reality. And so in my district, there's a 1 megawatt solar array. It takes up 5 acres of land. That 1 megawatt solar array over the course of a year generates the same amount of electricity as the Prairie Island Nuclear Plant generates in 90 minutes. 90 minutes. So I appreciate the good intentions. Everyone has we have the same shared goals, but the data, the science, and the reality is that solar panels in Minnesota have a capacity factor of 15%, and they just don't generate that much energy.
That was more than 30 seconds.
Yeah, it was. That's true.
I wish we had more time to visit with you because I really appreciate your beginning remark when you said, kids shut down if you don't offer them hope. And that is invaluable. Thank you so much for coming.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Dan Joel is next. Thank you for coming. We are a bit pressed for time, so about 10 minutes.
Okay. I'll be brief. All right. Thank you, Madam Chair.
But I know you have lots to tell us about,
okay.
So welcome.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dan Jewell. I'm the chairman of Jewell Energy, a longtime Minnesota company who's been involved in the development of renewable energy. We are a development and a technology company, so we develop projects. I think we've developed probably 35 to 40 community-based wind farm projects and solar projects over the years and capitalized about $500 million worth of things in the ground that are operating and producing power. So when we started in this business, obviously I was talking to Representative Wagenius when we first came in, and I remember when she came in 1970 or 1986 or 87, and I had just finished building the first wind farm in the Midwest for Northern States Power as part of the Sherco 3 settlement, if you'll remember what that was. And at that time, when we put that wind farm in the ground, I think our cost was right around 35 cents a kilowatt hour. It was crazy. It was very high. And it was just because the technology was pretty immature. And as time moved on, I built the next wind farm, or another wind farm, in 1997 in Woodstock, which is one of the first ones on the Buffalo Ridge. And that one we produced power for about 5 to 6 cents a kilowatt hour. But one of the things that I did on that wind farm is I put solar on the building because I needed power for my building. And at that time, I paid $11 a watt for the solar. Today, we pay 35 cents a watt. And so, you know, when you look at all of the things that have been happening over the years in this business, in developing the technology and getting it into the mainstream part of the business, it's changed dramatically from what we would just have this discussion about, well, the cost of this and that. And I'm here today. I've been asked to come and talk to you about the project we just put in online for a rural electric co-op in Minnesota, Lake Region Rural Electric Co-op. In this project, we use the solar and wind as a hybrid, where we've combined these technologies. We've been working with GE for several years to develop the technology where we take the converter from the wind turbine, the converter that converts the kinetic energy into usable energy, and we adapted that to accept solar as an input. And the reason we did that was because we wanted to deliver peak power during the summer and winter peaks. You know, solar capacity factor is relatively low. You're right, Representative, that it's got a low annual capacity factor because of where we live. But it is a seriously peaking energy resource. Our summer peaks are always hit by the hot summer days. And you combine that with the wind turbine technology that we've developed over the years that is extremely efficient. That delivers power on the windiest, coldest days of the year when we hit the winter peaks. And you start combining these technologies with a little bit of storage, you've got firm, clean power with no fuel, no emissions, no waste, no water, and no transmission costs ever. You think about that. Think about how we buy electricity and how we make electricity. And then you look at how our state, we spend $18 billion a year importing energy. And we've got all of these resources in our backyard. We've got solar and wind. And the solar does its job, and the wind does its job at the time when it's needed the most. And that's what we really need to think about when we look at this. The project we're doing for Lake Region Electric Co-op is a true solar-wind hybrid. We're delivering power there for half the price that they normally pay for it. Half the price that they normally pay their G&T right now. You think about that. And so this ball is rolling down the hill. We have the technology. We have the ability to produce this power and deliver it to our communities and really use this as a rural economic development tool. If we can keep our energy dollars in our state and our community and create jobs in the process, all we have to do is recognize what is the true cost of energy to our communities. It's a home run for us. And, you know, you folks, it's your job to look out for our state and do the best thing for our state. And we're sitting right at the edge right now where we've spent 40 years developing this technology. And it's ready to do this job. We just want to have the political will to do it. And I see that when we talk about portfolio standards and so on. But these days, all we need to do is look at what is the true cost. One of the other representatives talked about the cost of carbon. That's, you know, these are true costs. And when we can develop and produce this energy and deliver it to our communities, create jobs, keep energy dollars in our community with no fuel, no emissions, no waste, no water, and no transmission costs ever, that's the true economic value of what we're doing. And we can do it now if we just get the political will. So I really thank you, Chairman Wagenius and members of the committee to ask me to come here because we really need to get the message out that the time has come for us to really step up and do something with these technologies that we've all put into over the years. I mean, when we started back in the days with Prairie Island and this and that, it wasn't always that cost effective, but we had the political want to try to do something about the environmental side of it. Now this is an economic issue. We can produce cheaper energy here than we can import it. And I believe that's the message I want to give to you today. Thank you.
Are there questions? I go back to your beginning when you said the first wind farm was 35 cents a kilowatt hour. Was that it?
It was about that, yes. It was, I think we put it in 1986, we put in 365 kilowatt machines, and the amount of energy that they produced was fairly small because the rotors weren't very big. They were 15 meters in diameter. When we did the math on it, the cost was right around 30 cents a kilowatt hour to do that. But it was done, NSP did it as part of the Sherco 3 agreement. And it was the first, we built the first wind farm outside of California here in Minnesota with that. And it was a small wind farm, obviously, but it was the first step. But that just gives you a look at where the cost has gone. And today, you know, what we can deliver power for with wind is, you know, under 3 cents, easily under 3 cents.
Any other questions? I don't. Yes, Representative Swisinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, thank you for your presentation. You know, it's just interesting. You know, we talk about political will. You know, from what you say, we don't need a mandate. If you can deliver that power for that price, you don't need political will for that. You can just go talk to those investors. You can talk to those places and sell it to them if they need to buy the energy. You should be able to make that sale to them. You don't need political will for that. You don't need to come to this committee hearing and ask us to do a mandate or that, right?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative, the political will is more into getting to shift the entrenched system. The entrenched system doesn't want to see us produce our own power. I mean, the project we did for Lake Region Electric Co-op, we had resistance from the entrenched system. They want us to keep buying that coal from North Dakota. They want us to keep doing that, right? And that's where the political will comes in, is we have our own resources. We have the technology to do it here. But the entrenched system is going, wait a minute. We want you to keep buying this coal. We do not want you to do this yourself. And we see that on a regular basis when we do these things. Now, the biggest utility in the state, Xcel Energy, is doing a great job. They see it. They see that they need to move towards this clean energy and sustainable energy, mainly because it's an economic issue. They're doing it, but not everybody in the state is doing it. And where I live, I live in greater Minnesota. I live up in the Red River Valley, Red Lake Falls, Minnesota. And the whole western part of our state is we're completely susceptible to what happens to carbon in the future because all of our energy comes from these coal fields in North Dakota. And so if we keep our head in the sand and we don't start moving in a direction where we can develop our own sustainable resources, when something does happen, when the rest of the world comes down on us and says we need to do something about carbon, we're going to be paying higher rates where I live. And if we can do something about that now, we should start doing it. And we can do it. We just have to have the political will to do it.
Thank you so much for coming. I appreciate it.
You bet. Thank you.
And next, we have our last testifier is Troy Adams, General Manager of Elk River Municipal Utilities. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, my name is Troy Adams. I am the General Manager for Elk River Municipal Utilities, and it is an honor to be invited to come and present about a success story that we have. We moved to a greener generation mix with a new wholesale power provider, but also were able to go back and lower rates to our community. So first of all, I just want to pause and talk a little bit about who we are. I don't have a presentation or handouts because historically municipals are pretty bad about patting ourselves on the back. And I don't have anything prepared to kind of do that. We are owned by our community. We don't have shareholders. We have citizens that have invested into the assets that make up our community. So I understand, believe me, I understand the concept of stranded investment with building new generation before you've retired old generation. I understand the subsidies related to net metering. And I understand that some generation mixes are more expensive than others on the market. To take a little step back, in 2008, we were buying power from a local cooperative G&T that was located in our town, contractually through one of their co-op members. We received a notice of cancellation, a 10-year notice of cancellation in 2008. And it put the municipal in a pretty difficult position. And we are governed autonomously from the city, but the city is responsible for the creation of the utility. At that time, the previous general manager had left, and I was given the keys to the system and I had to go down to the city and present why they shouldn't sell us. From that moment forward, we put together a plan on how we were going to protect our future for our community, for the assets that the community had invested in. And so we looked at, informally, it was like a triple bottom line approach where we were looking at rates and the environment and the community. A little more complicated than that, but basically that was it. We're in a very conservative area and rates matter. I would say it's safety, reliability, and rates, but rates probably bump up to number two in the mind of the community. And so for us to make a change, number one, we had to deliver on a cost basis. But while we were doing that, we were also looking to position ourselves to the future. So one of the things that we find we're successful doing is when you have opposing views, it's best to find where you have common ground. We were able to look to the future as far as resources that would make sense for the long term. but also choose resources that position us to mitigate potential risks or costs. And so we went through about a five-year process to select a new wholesale power provider, and we ended up selecting an agency that was made up of like-minded or similar-sized metro, mostly metro, municipals. And so there's a little bit of safety in numbers, but also the ability to communicate and understand with each other because we kind of experienced the same sort of things. And so the new wholesale power provider, Minnesota Municipal Power Agency, brought us in, and even before we were receiving power, we were allowed a seat on the board and able to contribute and vote on things that would matter to our community in the future, which we didn't have that as an opportunity before. So now we're able to talk about the costs and the portfolio and our goals for the future and really impact those that live in our community and have paid for us in the first place. So with this transition, the actual transition happened on October 1st, 2018. And we went from a predominantly coal-based portfolio to a system that has no coal. And partially that is just luck of timing. The power agency that we're a part of started later than the G&T had and didn't own any coal. And we have a state-of-the-art combined cycle plant, but also have a pretty diverse portfolio of other resources, which I think is actually key to success, location and some diversity. And we were able to sell that basically back to our community that we have moved forward in our portfolio. But additionally, our rates, our wholesale power costs went down substantially. And we were able to go back this year and announce up to a 5% reduction in rates to our community. So for something where we went from being considered for sale to turning around and delivering a product that is going to position us well for the future and in the immediate year be able to turn around and lower rates, we're very proud of having been able to deliver that. In addition to that, we've also done quite a few other things to kind of position ourselves for the future, and we've been very active with electric vehicles, and we've put in a DC fast charger and two level two chargers in town. We happen to be the perfect distance between the cities and the lake for charging. So most people know Elk River because of all the stoplights. We also have charging. The city participated in the Climate Smart Cities and had people go to Germany to learn. And we have a city council created commission on energy and efficiency that we're called Energy City. So we're doing other things, but ultimately in our area, it's very conservative and the rates matter. So we were able to do all those things while actually lowering the rates. And with that, I guess I'll take any questions.
Members, questions? I don't see any questions. Thank you. Well, yes.
We've got evidence.
Go for it. Yes. Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Adams, congratulations on a job well done. I'm hearing that a lot of utilities are meeting and exceeding the goals for renewable energy. And I'm hearing from folks I know in the power industry who are saying that mandates can actually have a negative effect and can actually raise costs for a lot of that technology that you're forced to invest into. And I'm wondering your thoughts on increasing mandates versus allowing the market to drive those changes.
So I can speak on my own feelings on that, and not necessarily for our power agency, but our work with the power agency, we've gone to a more greener portfolio without a mandate because we're making decisions when it's cost effective and we're able to provide value. And a lot of times it has to do with location and it has to do with the resource and it has to do with where the load is. And so we've been able to do those from a business perspective while also delivering other benefits. And so thinking back to when the renewable energy standard was passed, those first contracts that utilities had to take out to meet the first goal were more expensive because they were a premium and a mandate. Since though, most utilities are able to actually meet that requirement, there are utilities that are adding green energy to their portfolio at a lower cost because it's available, not because it's mandated. So I guess to answer your question, personally, I think it's going there regardless of a mandate. Thank you.
Representative Long.
Thanks very much for your testimony. You mentioned stranded assets. So is there, when you brought that up, is there a concern that some utilities may not be able to move to as clean electricity as you have, even if it's cost competitive, if they have things like coal plants on their books?
Timing is everything. And sometimes you're lucky to be able to make important decisions at the right time. If you had a power plant that was not fully depreciated and you had to retire it early, would be a hit to your ratepayers. That is true. I'm not an accountant, I'm an engineer, so I'll qualify my answer.
Thank you for that. We have someone who signed up for public testimony. We said 2 minutes, but let me tell you, in our next hearing, we will have a lot of time for public testimony, and that's next Tuesday. Our committee administrator has arranged for a room for us to be take additional testimony in the afternoon, and given the number of people that seem to be signing up, I am quite sure we will be taking testimony in the afternoon. It's open for anybody, because we are going to be talking about, so I get the message, 4:30 in this room next Tuesday. So we will have extra testimony. So with that, thank you so much, and we'll hear from Jerry Nickey from the Minnesota Biofuels, and we have 2 minutes.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for having me here today. My name is Timothy Rudnicki. I do represent the Minnesota Biofuels Association, and I will give you some metrics, but I can assure you we have reports from Argonne National Laboratory, the Energy Resources Center in Chicago, out of the University of Illinois Chicago, and other scientists who can substantiate what I'm going to share with you. The key point I want to leave with you now, after all the things you've heard, is that the caption I'm talking under here is called Minnesotans Making Progress in Energy Efficiency, Renewables, and Climate Change. I'm underscoring that point because it was some of you and your predecessors, Republicans and Democrats, that recognized years ago the externalities do not get counted when you're talking about fossil fuels. Petroleum does not include health harms. Petroleum prices at the pump do not include costs associated with climate change, and the list goes on and on. So why does this matter, and how does this relate to biofuels that I'll share with you in a few moments? You and your colleagues at the state and federal level here had the vision, the foresight, to recognize that Minnesota does not deal in fossil fuels. We have solar, we have wind, and we have biomass. And the biomass that I'm going to be discussing in a few moments here is used to make biofuels, ethanol in particular. Why does this matter? Again, your vision, because the externalities are not included, supported stimuli to get the biofuel industry going in Minnesota. Here's what that has resulted in over the course of more than a decade. As of 2017, the ethanol industry in Minnesota contributed $2.17 billion to the state's economy. $1.54 billion went to household income, and the list goes on. The other important thing, thanks to the vision and the recognition that the system is stuck and it didn't include the externalities, 18,800 jobs are supported by the biofuel industry in Minnesota. That's not only the men and women who run the ethanol plants, but it includes engineering firms, accountants, and the list goes on. Again, metrics, I'm more than happy to provide that for you. Now, in terms of energy efficiency and renewables, I'm going to do an extremely compressed set of metrics. When I'm talking with you about the carbon dioxide equivalent reduction that biofuels has provided for Minnesotans so far, we're talking about carbon dioxide, CO2, nitrous oxide, and methane. So these are the potent greenhouse gases. So in a nutshell, through the vision that lawmakers here had, the biofuel industry, by providing E10, that's 10% alcohol and 90% petroleum gasoline, up until about last year, had the equivalent effect of removing 150,527 spark ignition powered vehicles from the roads. And that's by using 10% alcohol. And then with 5% additional alcohol, we can remove another 75,000 vehicles from the road. That gets us to, I guess, what I'd call the next policy request, which I'll save for another conversation. But thank you for listening to me, and I look forward to providing you with substantive details so we can keep making progress. Thank you.
Thank you so much, members. We will see you on Tuesday. With that, the meeting is adjourned.